Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The Farm Bill is up for debate in the Senate. It's a very important piece of legislation that determines everything from subsidies, nutrition in schools, and food stamps. Today's guest, Daniel Imhoff, says the U.S. faces a number of complex and farming-related challenges. Curbing the obesity epidemic, halting the loss of habitat, stopping disease outbreaks like E. coli. He believes the Farm Bill is our chance to right things that are wrong with the food system. Daniel Imhoff has spent 20 years working on issues related to farming and the environment. He's the author of a number of books, including CAFO, The Tragedy of Industrial Animal Factories. His latest book is Food Fight, The Citizen's Guide to the Next Food and Farm Bill. Hi, Dan. Welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Great to have you. And it's important to note that U.S. food policy greatly affects food systems around the globe. According to Raj Patel, unless you're a food executive, the food system is not working for you. At a time when we produce more food than ever, 1 in 7 people on the planet are hungry, and another 2 billion or so are overweight. Both are symptoms of poverty directly related to chains of food production. Raj Patel is a writer, activist, and visiting scholar at UC Berkeley's Center for African Studies. He's worked for the World Bank, WTO, and the UN. And he's been tear gassed on 4 continents protesting those organizations. He's the author of Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System. And he's out with a revised and expanded edition. And Raj joins me in studio. Hi, Raj. Thanks for coming in.
It's good to be with you, Rose.
Great to have you. So why don't we talk about the news that's coming out of Washington right now? And let's start with you, Dan. What do we need to know about the Farm Bill? This comes up every 5 or 7 years. Very important piece of legislation. Yet, a lot of people really couldn't tell you what it does.
Yeah, well, exactly. I think maybe it starts with the name, just that we call it the Farm Bill. And, it started with this very obscure piece of legislation a long time ago, but actually when we were in the midst of the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl, so there couldn't have been anything more important. And it's evolved over the last 80 years to become this incredibly important driver in all things related to food and agriculture and even land conservation on our continent here. It comes up every 5 to 7 years, as you said, for renewal. And right now, it's really heating up because the Senate has made its own draft of the Farm Bill. And in the next few weeks, it will consider that draft Farm Bill, as well as about, you know, dozens and dozens of amendments that are both related and unrelated to it, as the Senate tries to get this passed.
And it's expected to cost about $969 billion over the next 10 years?
Yeah, so call it a trillion.
Okay, so a trillion. So what's really at stake here?
Well, at stake is really, you know, who rules the food system, who, what crops are grown, under what conditions, what landowners and farmers benefit, what constitutes a farmer. But then, you know, there's the biggest part of the bill in the last 10 years has really become the food stamp, the nutrition programs. They're 80% of all spending. And when you're out on the street now, you look, 1 out of every 7 people is on food assistance. Mm-hmm. And so what comes out of the Farm Bill really affects whether or not people get enough to eat and what they get to eat, what kinds of foods they get to eat. And then even more importantly, though, for me especially, the Farm Bill is our chance to take to make up for things that the market doesn't compensate someone for. And right now, and it's been this way for a century, the only way farmers really can get ahead in this market is to grow as much as they can. And the more they grow, the lower the price grows. And the more pressure they have to put on our natural resources, our soil, our water, what remains of habitat and farmland, that really becomes what we give to the next generation in terms of a land conservation ethic. Mm-hmm. And so the conservation programs of the Farm Bill are extremely important as well.
Raj, you don't specifically focus on the farm bill per se, but what would you say, or how would you describe how U.S. policies affect what's happening in the world? Because what Daniel just described when he's talking about farmers, it reminds me of so many of the stories you tell in your book, that people around the globe are facing similar problems, especially farmers.
Well, the farm bill has ripple effects globally. For example, I mean, when we subsidize and when we mandate that there is an increase, that we would encourage U.S. farmers to grow corn, for example, to be turned into ethanol, to turn, you know, to make biofuels, which, you know, which is a preposterous idea, right? We're growing food not in order to eat it, but to set it on fire. Now, that mandate, which is part of U.S. agricultural policy, is something that had a profound ripple effect around the world in 2008, for instance, when we all felt the food prices rising, and according to the World Bank, for example, the majority of that food price rise came from the ethanol mandate and biofuels in the United States. Now, I think that that's an overestimate, but it's certainly true that by shaping the markets for agricultural products and for mandating where they end up, the U.S. is able to punch well above its weight in the international agricultural markets. And that also matters when it comes to food aid. The United States is really among one of very few countries that still insists that when we're giving away, when we're supporting people in countries where there is acute hunger, the food must come from the United States and be shipped on U.S. ships. And that's part of the Farm Bill, too, and something that I think that's part of U.S. agricultural policy. And something I think that we absolutely need to be looking at. But the trouble with all of this, and particularly when it comes to the Farm Bill, is that a lot of the effects are opaque. This morning I was reading a report out by Bay Area activist Michelle Simon, who was pointing out that, for example, in the food stamp part of the Farm Bill, which is really the largest part, as Dan was saying, we don't know which companies are benefiting from the Farm Bills. I mean, we know that one in seven Americans are on SNAP entitlements, on these Supplementary Nutritional Assistance Program entitlements, these food stamps is what they used to be called. But we don't know that the companies that are benefiting from that. And that seems to me, you know, this lack of transparency when it comes to the Farm Bill is a problem. I mean, if you look at, if you can go to the Pentagon, you go to the Department of Defense and look at their contracts, you can see who it is that we're paying to make bombs, but you can't see who it is that we're paying to feed our children.
So there's, why is that? I mean, how can we get that information?
Well, it's going to require a political pressure. I mean, I think that's, the USDA is, I mean, no part of government likes the rays of sunlight being shone on it, but the USDA is particularly, it seems, averse to having, you know, having light shone on its internal processes. And I think the only way that happens is if we demand that kind of change.
Well, and also it's hard to wrap your head around a lot of these issues, Dan. I mean, when you look at just how globalized the food system has become, it's really incredible. When you read Raj's book, I was just telling him on one page, he could name four different countries because things are so connected now. Your book, Dan, The Citizen's Guide to the Next Food and Farm Bill, you wrote this so we could actually wrap our heads around the Farm Bill. What are some of the first steps we should take to understand why this is important and how we can make our voices heard at this crucial time?
Well, you know, programs like this are really important. I kind of feel like, you know, we've really crashed through a wall in the last 6 or 7 years now. The first edition of that book came out in 2007, and it was to prepare people for the last Farm Bill, the previous Farm Bill. And I don't sense the level of interest and understanding of the importance of this bill, as I do this year, where I think people really get it. Wow, this is important, and it's not just this bill that affects a very narrow band of congressional districts in the Corn Belt and in the South that grow corn, cotton, wheat, rice, soybeans. It's actually determines what goes on our plates. And so I think education is the first key. What's been really interesting for me in the last few years is in a couple of years back, a group from Seattle started to buy boxes of my book they call up and they buy a box at a time, like 30 copies. And I was thinking, what is going on? Well, they started this Farm Bill reading group and Farm Bill think tank coalition up in Seattle. And the next thing you knew, the Seattle City Council brought together a very, very diverse community of farmers, health practitioners, city government officials, activists, funders, and they wrote their own Farm Bill principles. And they were very sound. They basically said, look, the Farm Bill is an urban issue too, and we're concerned about nutrition and conservation and regional food systems in case, you know, there's some disruption from high oil prices or climate change or something that's out of their control. And they wanted to see these federal dollars go toward a different kind of regional health-centered agriculture. Those principles were later adopted by the U.S. The National Council of Cities and then the U.S. Council of Mayors. And so we have like 20 major cities now: Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, Portland, Baltimore, Philadelphia, that have written letters to the ag committees that are saying this Farm Bill really has to tackle these issues that are related to urban folks as well. And I think that's what the average citizen needs to do, is to find a way to make this their issue, and then find a way to make their voice heard, which is really just, you know, a phone call away.
That sounds exciting, actually, that so many people are getting involved. And you said that you feel like there's more interest this year than you've seen in the past?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, just the press alone. But interest does not translate necessarily into political power.
Right.
You know, and so you can't believe the amount of money that is going in to influence this bill. The very, very narrow number of congressional districts that are represented on the committees that really write the bills. And so our only hope is to go from outside the committee to have, you know, senators, representatives bring in amendments that change the way these rules are really written, and they're dominated by the industrial food system. Well, find a way in, get this bill back and make it a more popular bill.
Well, and I'd like to talk about special interests and the money that's involved in this. But before we do that, since you did bring up positive organizing, Dan, Raj, why don't you add to that? Because in your book, you have so many stories about organizing. And since we're talking about domestic issues, why don't we talk about what's happening in Northern California?
Well, I mean, the Bay Area has long been the sort of hub for thinking about food. Alice Waters and Chez Panisse sort of started a revolution in the way we consume food, but also in the way that we think about the supply chain and how consumers, how eaters and growers fit together. But it's really been, you know, over the past 20 years or so that we've seen a sort of an explosion of groups, particularly here in the Bay Area, where you've got, you know, in the East Bay, you've got City Slicker Farms and the People's Grocery and Fat Beats and, you know, Food First, obviously, since the 1970s. But also concerted groups that are bringing together activists and municipal city councils and small businesses, things like the Oakland Food Policy Council. You've also got a very deep interest in understanding the link between food and education. So the Edible Schoolyard, for example, one of the offsprings of the Chez Panisse, is in Berkeley, but also in Hunter's Point, these edible schoolyards are becoming an important part of a curriculum where, sadly, you know, because of the marketing flung at our kids, children today are far more prone to believe that food comes from a supermarket than it does from the ground. And these edible schoolyards are a way of bringing back that kind of education. But we've been really lucky in Northern California to really have been at the center of organizing around food and, you know, fights for justice. I mean, right here in the Bay Area, for example, we were home to an amazing organization that at one point in its history was feeding more people than the state of California was, really going after poor children and children of color. And that organization, of course, was the Black Panthers. Mm-hmm. The Black Panthers had a school breakfast program in the late 1960s and early 1970s that shamed the federal government into properly funding its nutrition programs. But it's been the success of organizing in the Bay Area and obviously internationally, but really in the Bay Area we're very lucky to have a lot of these organizations that do link issues around food, poverty and justice together in ways that are really important but also really delicious.
That is Raj Patel. He is author of Stuffed and Starved: The Hidden Battle for the World Food System. He's out with a revised and expanded edition, and I will be in conversation with Raj tonight at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco at 6:30. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Dan Imhoff. He's spent 20 years working on these issues related to farming and the environment. His latest book is Food Fight: The Citizen's Guide to the Next Food and Farm Bill. And we'd love to hear from you. When we're talking about the Farm Bill, it's such a massive piece of legislation, $1 trillion over 10 years. What questions do you have about it? And if you have any questions about the world food system, what's so amazing about all of this is that it's so connected. What happens in the U.S. affects farmers in India and Korea. So we'd love to talk to you. We'd love to get your questions about how it's all connected and what concerns you have about that. And if you're involved in any food justice movements, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So let's talk about some specifics. Dan, why don't you talk about one or two things in this bill that would make a huge difference? What kinds of changes would you like to see?
Well, traditionally, in the last, you know, many, many decades, the Farm Bill has really focused on the agricultural side on a very number of crops that I mentioned before. Corn, which Raj talked about, is the big winner. Corn, cotton, wheat, rice, soybeans, milk are the main winners. And of those crops, a very, very small hand, about 65% of those crops aren't really eaten by humans directly. They're fed to animals in confinement. They're distilled into biofuels. They're manufactured into the building blocks of industrial food and fast food. And I think that there was probably a time in the last century when we came out of a couple world wars, when we had this population explosion. There was this agricultural science that was trying to make sure we were going to save humanity from famine and make sure everybody had enough to eat. And also, in some cases of countries, to make agriculture this really vital global business that could at least provide some kind of income in a world that was being dominated by international manufacturing, and our jobs were, you know, at stake. And so I think we created a system, highly successful system, of creating food that I think now is showing us is really unhealthy. We have 2 out of 3 people who are overweight and obese. But more than that, just the way that we're producing this food, the environmental and the community health impacts of that food is really important. So when you get into the Farm Bill and you get into these programs that send out very specific signals, money basically, that says no matter how much you grow, you're going to be compensated. Those are the things that really affect us. So when we look at the commodity title and the crop insurance title in this particular Farm Bill, I think that's where one of the big fights is going to be. You've seen sky-high commodity prices for the last 5 years. You see an agricultural sector that's increasingly dominated by bigger and bigger farms that are growing these very specific crops. And they're so powerful, what they're really asking for is just a guaranteed revenue stream. So the pushback on that. So, and let's just, if we step back and we say, all right, of that $1 trillion, how much of that money is going to go towards commodity spending? It's about 17 or 18% of that. So 17 to 18 cents out of a dollar is going to go toward commodity crops. The real question is, though, how do we put some practical limits on, you know, who really deserves support? At what income level? At what loss level? Right now, basically, these producers are so powerful, it doesn't matter how big they are, they're eligible for crops. It doesn't matter how much they've lost, they can still be eligible for crop insurance payments or commodity supports.
Well,
and there's no conservation requirement that says, you know, in return for this support, you're protecting the soil, you're protecting wetlands, you're protecting wildlife habitat. So those are two really important things that are on the table right now.
And Raj, what would you like to add when we're talking about food producers? What do we need to know about how they operate?
Well, I mean, I think one of the most important points to remember is that food producers are able to think for themselves. I mean, a lot of the work that I've done has been with an international food movement called La Via Campesina, which has, by some estimates, over 200 million members around the world, including right here in the United States. And the National Family Farm Coalition has very specific ideas about what it wants to see in the Farm Bill. It's important to bear in mind that when one hears about money going towards these producers, as Dan quite rightly points out, many of these producers are millionaires, whereas small family farmers are often given short shrift by the Farm Bill, both because of the crops that they produce. You know, fresh fruits and vegetables are far less subsidized, as Dan was saying, than these big commodity crops. Plus, you know, small family farmers are small, so even if you get a per acre subsidy, if you have a small farm, your subsidy is going to be way less. But those farmers have fantastic ideas, and those are ideas I think we ought to be rallying around, and we can find out more about that by going to their website, nffc.net.
Okay, thank you for that. And we have about a minute before we go to break, but Raj, I want to ask you the same question. To bring this down to the ground, what are one or two things that would make a big difference in the food system?
I mean, in terms of the food system, I think, first of all, as we mentioned earlier on, transparency. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the fact that the USDA is shielding the large supermarkets and the financial institutions that benefit from the food, you know, the SNAP entitlements, I think is a problem. We need much more transparency in the way that this bill operates. But I also think, you know, historically, the Farm Bill is a compromise between those who are fighting hunger through food banks and through these food entitlements and the support for agriculture. I think we need to be moving much more away from the U.S. Department of Agriculture to what Michael Pollan suggested was a Department of Food. Now, that's a much more radical shift, but I think that the Farm Bill is always going to be an exercise in patching up relations between these two different camps. And in fact, what we need to do is take the big step back and say, look, what we need to do is absolutely support our environment and support small family farmers, but also support every eater in America.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and now is the time to raise your voice. If you're concerned about these issues, they affect all of us because we're talking about food and what we eat on a regular basis, our farmers and the environment. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. We'll be back after this.
Hello, this is Chuck Feeney of Your Legal Rights. If you use a computer at work and would like to know what privacy rights you as an employee may have in using the computer, or if you're an employer and want to know what your rights are to access your employee's computer, please join me this Wednesday evening at 7. My guests will be employment law attorneys Brian Schwartz and Jonathan Wong. That's this Wednesday evening at 7 on Your Legal Rights here on 91.7 KLW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, Holly Kernan will have a conversation with Lindsay Hilsum, international editor for Channel 4 News and the author of the new book, Sandstorm, Libya in the Time of Revolution. She chronicles events in Libya before, during, and after the revolution through their eyes. That's tomorrow. And then on Thursday, we'll have a conversation with Eve Ensler about her new play, Emotional Creature. It's a celebration of girls and girlhood. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about food justice and the Farm Bill. The Farm Bill is up for debate right now. It will determine who will dominate our food system. The Farm Bill writes the rules and sets the playing field for the food system, determines what we eat, how much it costs, where it's grown. It also greatly affects the world's food supply because so much of our system now is globalized and connected. So what happens here affects everywhere from, you name it, India, Costa Rica, Africa. We'll talk about that later in the show. So if you have any questions about what's happening with the food bill, if you have concerns, we'd love to hear from you. What kinds of changes would you like to see? And if you're working in the food justice movement, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. We actually have a farmer on the line. So if you're a farmer, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Raj Patel, writer, activist, and visiting scholar at UC Berkeley's Center for African Studies. He's author of the revised version of Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System. And I'll be in conversation with Raj tonight at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. It starts at 6:30, and you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Daniel Imhoff. His latest book is Food Fight, The Citizen's Guide to the Next Food and Farm Bill. And let's go to a caller, an apple farmer, Carlisle in Carmel Valley. Hi, Carlisle. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. I'm Carlisle, and I've been an ALBA farmer, the Agricultural Land Base Training Association. It's an organic farm incubator. And we were given an alert this week from ALBA, but they were also, it came from the National Sustainability Agricultural Coalition, and they are asking for amendments to this farm bill, which Senator Brown from Ohio and Nelson are coming up with. They want in this farm bill to have beginning farmer and rancher development programs, financed, and outreach and assistance for socially disadvantaged farmers and rancher programs, and also more micro enterprise assistance programs. And so I just wanted to put a plug in for the National Sustainability Agricultural Coalition and ALBA that they're working on this, on putting in amendments to this particular farm bill, which I think are really important.
Yes, I'm so glad you brought that up, because we tend to hear about the amendments that food justice activists don't like, and we rarely hear about the amendments that they do like. So thank you, Carlisle, and it sounds like that's a great effort. Dan, what would you like to add to that? What amendments should we know about that are in the farm bill that food justice organizations are supporting?
Yeah, let me just clarify. I thank you very much for that call, Carlisle. It's the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition,
okay.
NSAC, and it's sustainableagriculture.net is where you can find a great amount of information. Senator Brown, as she said, has an amendment. And the important thing there is that there are many, many programs that right now that are very successful. Relatively small amounts of money, $50, $100, $150 million over 5 years spread around the 50 states can do amazing things to help farmer and rancher programs. So Senator Brown's amendment to fund the value-added producer grants and the beginning farmer programs is really important. Senator Gillibrand from New York has introduced a bill that would take excessive money going to crop insurance companies to pay part of their administrative costs and make sure that the SNAP program, the food stamp program, is not cut, because right now it's the Senate wants to cut $4.5 billion from that important program, which so many people depend on right now. It's going to be far worse in the House, however. Mm-hmm. Grassley and Conrad have an amendment that deals with competition in the livestock industry, which is really important for small farmers and ranchers, livestock operators, because it's so difficult for them to compete in the livestock industry. And this would really center in on packer control, so meat packers can't own livestock more than 14 days prior to slaughter, so they can't manipulate markets. So those are three out of like seven or eight, really. I could go on. There's a lot of really important amendments that senators need to hear about right now. And NSAC, National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition, is a really good place to find ways to, you know, get your senator on the line and give you some very informative analysis so that you can have a conversation.
Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat from Oregon, introduced an amendment that would allow farmers to grow industrial hemp. This is a big one. And I mention this because David Bronner, the CEO of Bronner Soap, was arrested yesterday in front of the White House. He caged himself in with 12 hemp plants. So you've got so much in this farm bill, everything from hemp to food stamps.
Yeah, no, I mean, listen, it's one of those, as a writer, it's one of those beautiful topics where, you know, you pull the string and you find the whole world attached to it. But as a citizen, it's a little daunting.
Yeah.
I think what's really interesting to me, Nancy Pelosi, who presided over the farm bill, the last farm bill, because the House is so important in the crafting of this bill, said that the farm bill used to be her least informed vote. And by the end of that process, she knew more about it than she ever wanted to know. But it was fascinating. And I think, you know, the challenge is, how do we get our representatives up to speed with how important we think food is?
Right.
Because, I mean, this is really an issue that brings everybody together, and everybody's increasingly saying, hey, we got to do something different.
And that was my next question, Dan. We're in California. We're surrounded by a number of powerful politicians. Which ones have the most influence on the farm bill?
Well, there's a number of Californians on the House Agriculture Committee and on the Appropriations Committee. Certainly, I think Senator Feinstein sits on the Appropriations Committee. Sam Farr sits on the Appropriations Committee. Those are the committees that actually dole out the budgets, and they do a lot of legislation as well, making sure certain programs get money. And then you have Representative Cardoza, and he, I think, is retiring, but his seat is very important on the House Agriculture Committee as well.
All right. Well, thank you again for calling in, Carlisle. And Raj, we have a question from Leslie in Berkeley. She'd like to know how subsidies of U.S. agribusiness and U.S. trade policies affect people like rice farmers in Haiti, corn farmers in Mexico, or cotton farmers in West Africa.
They affect them all. I mean, there was a very interesting report that came out recently about NAFTA, for example. And one of the things that's interesting is that, yes, the United States is the most overweight and most obese country on Earth. But people are sometimes shocked to hear that the second most obese country on Earth is Mexico. It's possible now to see that one of the reasons that so many people are overweight in Mexico is because of the trade relationship that they have with the United States. Mm-hmm. And it's an odd statistic, but the closer if you're in Mexico, the closer you get to the U.S. border, you know, outside Mexico City, the more overweight Mexican teenagers are likely to be. And that's important to note, because often we're told, well, you know, being overweight is just a personal personal failing. But if you believe that that's just a personal failing, then you have some explaining to do about this sort of curve of getting closer to the US border, and people are more individually fallible the closer they become to the United States. Of course, that doesn't make sense, but instead, what makes sense is a social explanation. The researchers have been able to chart out how, over the course of NAFTA, with the introduction of subsidized U.S. agricultural products, and with the entry into Mexico of Walmart, the kind of cheap, easy calories which we're used to in the United States have now become Mexico's as well. So that $1 in $5 spent in a grocery store in Mexico is spent at a Walmart, and the kinds of food that are sold there are not, you know, traditional healthy fresh fruits and vegetables, but much more the kinds of processed food that have caused the obesity epidemic here in the United States. So certainly, you know, opening up markets and throwing our subsidized products and our corporations into Mexico hasn't worked out well, but you could certainly tell a similar story about what has happened in Haiti with the imposition of structural adjustment policies that made Haiti's rice market open to the United States. And of course, as Dan was saying, rice is one of the crops we subsidize in some years up to the tune of $1 billion a year, whereas Haiti wasn't allowed to subsidize any of its rice. And so from being in a position at the beginning of the 1980s where Haiti grew the majority of its own rice, now Haiti is utterly dependent on the gifts of the United States, and that's a very conscious trade policy, and one for which Bill Clinton has actually apologized.
Right. You know, just quickly on NAFTA, I wanted to ask you, I think listeners would find this interesting. In your book, Raj, you write that a number of Mexican government officials went to school at the University of Chicago, and they brought that philosophy back to Mexico with them. And you report that the U.S. was concerned that the economic impacts of free trade on farmers would cause such poverty that it might destabilize the Mexican countryside. But Mexican negotiators reassured them that all would be well. We're often under the impression that the U.S. goes in with a big gun and says, this is how it's going to be. You have no say in this.
Right. And I think that's important to bear in mind, that often, you know, there's this sort of caricatured idea of the U.S. as the big bad guy, and third world countries are sort of hapless, sort of fall guys for the U.S. policy. Now, obviously, in some respects, that's true, particularly when it comes to climate change and what have you. But in this particular case, when it came to NAFTA, it was the Mexican government itself that wanted to eviscerate the Mexican peasantry, that wanted to throw small farmers out of the countryside, because the government, perhaps for benevolent reasons, though we can argue about that, but the government thought, well, you know, it's not doing peasants any good to be peasants. Instead, what they should do is have jobs in sweatshops, because their incomes will be higher. Mm. And the tragedy, of course, is, you know, the policy worked to the extent that the Mexican the Mexican small farmers found it impossible to survive. But the jobs that they then moved to get in terms of sweatshops were there for a little bit, and now have moved to China.
Mm. That is Raj Patel. He is author of the revised and expanded edition of Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System. We're also joined by Daniel Imhoff, author of Food Fight, The Citizen's Guide to the Next Food and Farm Bill. And if you want to raise your voice about the Farm Bill, now is the time to do it, because the Senate is debating it. It affects everything from, well, the growing of hemp to food stamps to school lunches, subsidies, you name it, it's in the Farm Bill. And if you have any questions about what's in it, now is a good time to call. We've got about 10 minutes left. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. And if you'd like to talk also about how U.S. policy really affects the global food system, we'll also talk with Raj about how the market and Wall Street speculators affect the food system. We'd love to hear from you if you're a farmer, if you work in the food justice movement. You can leave a comment also at yourcallradio.org. And a caller just rang in to say, please mention the Farm Bill is the Agricultural Reform Food and Jobs Act, and it is Bill S-3240. So thank you for calling in on that. And let's hear from Catherine in Berkeley. Hi, Catherine. Welcome to the show. Hi, Catherine. Catherine, are you there? I hear you. Catherine wanted to get some more information on a compromise between Republicans and Democrats. So, Dan, can you talk about, are there major differences on the Farm Bill between the Republicans and the Democrats?
I think the major difference really is in the House. So the Senate it's a lot easier to pass a farm bill in the Senate because there's a lot fewer people, and I think somehow the interests aren't as divisive. In the House, you have some fiscal conservatives that are calling for really, really deep cuts. And when you look at the farm bill, the biggest line item that you can cut is food stamps. And so the difference between the House and the Senate is quite, quite significant, where the Senate has proposed to cut $4.5 billion from food assistance programs. The House right now is looking at $33 billion. Yeah. And when you look at the Ryan budget, it's much higher than that. It's like $130 billion. So I think that really, you know, supporting big ag is very it's not a partisan issue at all. It's, you know, equal opportunity support for big agriculture. They are a force to be reckoned with, a lobbying force. I think then what you really find the partisanship over are these issues of social benefit, like nutrition assistance and conservation, and things that really have, you know, they really have a benefit to everyone. Everyone has, you know, has something to gain from having fresh water and soil protection and habitat, things that the market doesn't pay for. And of course, when we're struggling in an economy like we have, making sure that everybody's well fed, you know, is another extremely it's a big challenge, you know, and also it gets to that question, what is government's role in the food and agriculture system? That's really what the Farm Bill is addressing.
Right, and a lot of people also would like to know, what about the revolving door between the big food producers, Monsanto, the USDA? And Raj, can you jump in and talk about, you included this in the new version of your book, just about the market mechanisms involved in this, and how Wall Street really affects the food system.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm really glad that Dan brought up the amendments that are geared towards stopping the manipulation of markets by agribusiness, because we've seen increasingly that just as with finance and with everything else, frankly, the big corporations through this recession have used this recession as an opportunity to acquire and to acquire market share. So our financial system, for example, now is much more concentrated now than it was at the beginning of the recession. And that's true with large sections of the food supply chain as well. There are globally just five or six companies in every sector of the food system control about half the food system. So, you know, to give you an example, I mean, Unilever, for example, controls over 95% of the global packaged tea industry. But, you know, one company controlling that much is unusual. Normally, it's about sort of, you know, five or six companies controlling over half. But the hidden sort of forces here are trading companies that many people might not have heard of. I mean, obviously, KALW listeners are far more informed than average radio listeners, and will know about Archer Daniels Midland and Cargill as these giant companies that control the food system. But fewer people, I think, have heard of companies like Glencore. Mm. Glencore is a Switzerland-based trading company that controls 25% of the global barley market, for example. They're a company that advised the Russian government a couple of years back in the middle of when Russia was on fire and its grain shipments were about to be halted, and Glencore advised the Russian government not to to impose an export ban, which drove up the price of wheat globally tremendously. So, you know, you have these very, very powerful, shady companies in the background, and it seems pretty clear that as a result of their betting on food, we're seeing a lot more volatility, a lot more price swings in the price of food now, which is good if you're in the betting business, but not really good for you in any other way.
You know, I was recently in Costa Rica and was shocked at the high price of food. A basic can of tomato sauce, for example, is $2. A large plastic bottle of some kind of drink, like a vanilla kind of drink, $7. The quinoa, incredibly expensive. In fact, I've read that in South America, in many parts of South America, it's hard for the locals to buy the quinoa because we're buying so much of it.
Well, I mean, I think that also those high prices, bear in mind in the United States, we spend less of our income on food than anywhere else. I mean, the reason we have cheap food is because we have low wages. And I think that's the bigger issue here, is that if we're serious about having a better food system, we need to see where the thread goes, as Dan says. We need to increase wages. We need to think about better health care. We need to think about better retirement benefits.
So for us in the U.S., we're spending less on food because of our low wages. But in other countries, in a place like Costa Rica, they're spending almost more than half of their income on food.
Well, I mean, I think really what we need is both to make sure that everyone in the food system is being paid well. I mean, you know, there was a report came out very recently that over 80% of people who are working in the food system in the United States don't make enough to live.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we need to pay them a decent wage, but that means raising the price of food. But that shouldn't penalize the poor. We shouldn't have people going hungry in the United States. I mean, I think what we're losing sight of here is it's an embarrassment to the richest country on earth that one in seven of its citizens depend on nutritional assistance.
Well, and also we've done shows about the fact that people working in the Central Valley who pick our food cannot afford to eat our food. Does anything in the Farm Bill affect that, Dan?
Well, certainly I think there's attempts in recent years to make fresh foods more available to the poor, even to people who have SNAP benefits. So, for example, there are programs that double your purchase power when you're at a farmer's market. If you buy fruits and vegetables with your EBT, your SNAP food stamp card, you can get twice the value. And there's a lot of private and public money that are matching federal dollars to try to improve health that way. But to me, really, the zeros aren't there. There just simply aren't enough zeros right now, and it's not the priority that it really has to be, given, you know, that we know so much of this nutritional epidemic that we're facing right now is related to diet. The other tragedy, though, really in the Farm Bill is that, you know, there's 6 million, 7 million laborers that do the backbreaking work of agriculture, and at least half of them are undocumented. There is no labor title in the 1,000-page Farm Bill that really is directed toward the people who do most of the really difficult and highly skilled work of raising food.
Why is that?
You know, I mean, they don't have a lobby. They don't have a voice, and I think, you know, it's also a result of kind of a tragic immigration policy. Mm. But they certainly are, they're the forgotten force that really makes our food system as powerful as it is. And, you know, I would like to say that, you know, we have to fight this fight if we care about change at the federal level. But I also have this glimmer of hope on the regional level that from Washington to Oregon to California, from Seattle to San Diego and the Sierras to the coast, that we could develop our own regional priorities for food production because we're very similar politically, economically, highly productive, and make this a goal that, you know, we're going to take care of our workers and our people and grow the highest quality food possible and make that as accessible as possible. And I kind of feel like that is something that starts, and it includes animal welfare and includes includes humans as well, welfare. You know, that's something that I see on the horizon.
Yeah, and that's something we can really wrap our arms around, because when you're talking about commodities, Wall Street speculation, subsidies, a lot of people feel like, well, how can I really influence that other than maybe making a call, which is obviously very important. But when you can talk to a friend about farm workers, or how animals are treated, for example, that's more tangible. What would you add to that, Raj, just to make it real, especially in a place like the Bay Area where, frankly, a lot of people go to farmers markets and, you know, we feel like we've got access to all of these great fresh fruits and vegetables?
Well, I mean, I think Dan's right that farm labor is the sort of are the forgotten constituency in these debates. Even when we're thinking about eating local, it is the backbreaking work in the fields that's entirely compatible, for example, with eating organic. We had had a case of just a couple of years back of workers working on organic farms and one of them dying because of heat exposure. Mm-hmm. So, I think, again, what's important to bear in mind is that farm workers are articulate and are able to speak for themselves. And if people want to hear what farm workers are talking about, the coalition of Immokalee workers, for instance, who produce many of the tomatoes that are in our our fast food products, are very articulate, and you can find out more about them at ciw-online.org.
And final thoughts as we wrap this up, what would you say is the most effective action people can take on these issues?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, starting to get involved in one of the many organizations that are right here in the Bay Area. And as I say, you know, from Food First to Fat Beats, you know, there are fantastic organizations that plug into whatever your passion is. And actually, when we get organized, we're part of a much bigger movement rather than, I mean, obviously, eating smart is a good thing because eating stupid is not so good, right? I mean, you eat smart and buy, you know, shop smarter. But I think also, you know, getting involved in these organizations, which are right here in the Bay Area, is going to be the way we grow the food movement.
And Dan, what would you add to that? We have about a minute left.
Well, I
And
call their senators. You can get a lot of good information from Roots of Change, Environmental Working Group, food2012.org. Make a call to your senators. Tell them that you want these amendments to improve the bill as it stands right now.
And you can find more information about the bill and how you can get involved. And we'll put some information about amendments so you can also maybe talk about some of those when you call in. Daniel Imhoff is author of Food Fight, The Citizen's Guide to the Next Food and Farm Bill. And Raj Patel is author of the revised and expanded edition of Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System. And I'll be in conversation with Raj tonight at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. We will talk about the global food supply. It starts at 6:30. Find more information, yourcallradio.org. Dan and Raj, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you.
Good to talk to you, Raj.
Good to talk to you, Dan.
Thanks.
And thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. What can we learn from what's happening in Libya? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Lindsay Hilsum, international editor for Channel 4 News and author of Sandstorm, Libya and the Time of Revolution. Hilsum chronicles events in Libya before, during, and after the revolution through the eyes of Libyans. How did Libyans live under Gaddafi's autocratic rule? Who's in power in Libya today? And what do you want to know about Libya? It's Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor. And Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in San Francisco. Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.